From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about university investment funds and endowments, and the demand student protesters are making about transparency.
Without being able to know what specific individual investments are being made, we don't know where all of it's going because they haven't disclosed it.
We'll learn about the millions of cicadas emerging from the ground this summer. Plus, we'll speak with a world champion taxidermist who preserved the beloved Milwaukee County Zoo gorilla, Samson.
I'm extremely passionate about wildlife. A lot of it started out when I was young and I would see animals hit by cars laying on the roadside. You know, I always thought, oh gosh, what a shame. It would be so cool if I could make that animal look lifelike again.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The cicadas are coming. You can expect to hear a lot of this in the next few weeks as millions of cicadas emerge from the ground. We'll learn more about the periodical phenomenon later in the show. We'll start with this. Late last week, pro-Palestinian encampments came down across UW campuses after demonstrators reached an agreement with university leadership. A lot of the student protests centered around divesting from Israel and fuller transparency around university investments. And while the encampments are down, those conversations are just beginning. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by Liam Barron, a Madison-based reporter who wrote about the protests and endowments, to learn what the demonstrators are asking for.
Pro-Palestinian demonstrators at UW-Madison have outlined six demands. First off are divestment from companies that are aiding Israel and its war efforts during the Israel-Hamas war, and disclosure of our university foundation's investments. So the UW Foundation doesn't have to publicly disclose individual investment details, which is something that the protesters are asking for. Mm-hmm. They've also asked to cut ties with Israeli institutions. So some of those are research programs, study abroad programs. There's a graduate exchange fellowship, which has been named. They've asked our university to call for an immediate permanent ceasefire. They've asked the university to get cops off campus. And they've asked the university to stop land grabs and cease expansion in order to house the community.
What exactly are they getting specific about that's in the UW's portfolio that students have issues with?
Yeah, so this is a really good question because it's pretty complicated. So partially what the protesters are looking at is the UW Foundation. So that's the nonprofit private corporation that manages the UW-Madison's nearly $4 billion investment endowment, which the university can draw upon in order to receive funds. So endowments are largely sourced from donors and can range from, you know, multi-million to multi-billion dollar investments. I believe the largest one I've seen is at Harvard, which is approaching about $50 billion. So one of the parts with the UW Foundation is that because they aren't required to disclose their investments, it's not really a great idea of what's going on. A protest organizer I spoke to said, without being able to know what specific individual investments are being made, we don't know where all of it's going because they haven't disclosed it. And so those would also be a point of divestment. I spoke to a UW Foundation spokesperson who said that they outline their overall endowment details in a financial report, but don't disclose individual investment details.
I really would love to take us down kind of like a explainer 101 on some of these topics that you've reported, because a lot of them, to be honest, were quite new to me. And I'd love to start with, what do we know or should we know about the UW Foundation, which you've kind of been alluding to and kind of referencing as far as like who's controlling the money? What do we know about them and who runs it?
Yeah, so the UW Foundation has a governing board composed of UW-Madison alums and donors. So it's important to keep in mind that this is a donor-focused organization. They, you know, have fundraisers throughout the year in order to raise money. And so that governing board would be the one controlling the UW Foundation. Those would be the people that these student protesters would be eventually connected to. the chancellor, the university administration, does not have any sort of control over how that endowment's spent, what it's invested in. And so that's, you know, a sticking point in what our chancellor, Jennifer Mnuchin, has communicated to faculty, to protesters, et cetera.
The term endowments and how they work still feels a bit fuzzy to me. And I understand that it feels like a piggy bank that universities have and that they use and they spend at their discretion. But I would love if you could break down what they are and kind of why they're important here. And it seems specifically to UW-Madison, too.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Endowments are largely donor-sourced. They are assets or funds that accrue annual interest. So they're a nice way for the university to, you know, have a stable source of financial income, even given whatever other expenditures or circumstances it has happen in a given year. And like you said, it is pretty important for UW-Madison in particular. One thing that I noted in the article for Isthmus is that UW-Madison's philanthropic profile really makes it an outlier in terms of funding for UW system schools. You know, obviously we've seen over the past year that a lot of the other UW system schools are facing furloughs and layoffs and budget cuts in response to deficits. UW-Madison actually was able to tank some of those budget cuts, 7 million of them, because of its strong philanthropic profile. 33% of the university's revenue in 2023 compared to about 4.9% for other UW system campuses. So the endowment really is a strong point for UW-Madison. And because it is donor funded, one of the concerns that we've seen at other universities who are agreeing to take votes on their endowments, like say Brown University, is that this could inflame tensions with donors who make up the support of the endowment.
And you touched on kind of the cuts in funding, which has been front page, I think, for a while now with the UW system. Overall in the state, I know we've dropped from maybe middle of the pack to, I believe, 43rd in per pupil funding last year. And I just would love for you to touch a little bit more on what role the state funding or lack of it play in a process like this.
Yeah, so I think state funding is certainly a concern. I mean, I know also that the university's efforts in terms of how it has approached DEI programming in the past has been a concern in terms of state funding. I haven't heard anything in terms of how the legislature is receiving all this news, but I suppose it would be on their minds as well. But in terms of this particular ask, it's not super clear at this point how actively the university is considering what's happening in terms of state funding, in terms of what it does with the endowment, disclosure, with divestment. I really haven't seen a clear indication from the university in terms of what, you know, state funding plays in that decision-making process.
This next question, I feel, is a bit unfair. And I just want to preface that because I'm asking you to look in the future and predict kind of how negotiations may or may not go. A member of Students for Justice in Palestine said the resolution will come based on how willing the administration is to make commitments towards meeting their demands. What has to happen on both ends for a resolution?
Yeah, this is definitely a tricky question. And at this time, we're sort of seeing it play out in real time. You know, the university had said that they had walked away from the table in terms of demands. And the protesters have now maintained that they, in fact, walked out of the table but aren't ceasing talks. They said that the university isn't taking their demands seriously and isn't engaging with them enough. So on both ends, there's sort of, I guess, a difference in understanding of what can be done or a difference of what actions both parties are willing to take. You know, spokespeople haven't confirmed yet, but the student protesters said that the university put forth. The university in that resolution said that they would try and connect the student protesters to the relevant decision makers in exchange for the encampment coming down. The student protesters have outlined some modified demands alongside the sort of methods that they see the university using in order to enact them. And so on both ends, the protesters have said that they aren't going to capitulate, that they don't want just like connections or a vote on divestment, disclosure, the other demands, they want them to actually be met. But the university maintains that for some of those demands, it's just not going to happen. For, you know, getting police off campus, for example, a system spokesperson told me that it just can't happen legally, given the federal and state constraints on the UW system for, you know, cessation of programs with ties to Israel. That's been one where our chancellor said that that would be a violation of state law and that it just can't happen. Still, protesters have kept with those demands. And so for a resolution to happen, which, you know, the university certainly does want to happen prior to commencement, which they had mentioned in an email to students, there would need to be some sort of capitulation on either end.
You know, you had mentioned encampments. I was curious, what can we expect of the status of these encampments to be as the negotiations continue on and they get more fraught or middle ground is found?
It's a good question. It's sort of the lingering question in the air right now. The protesters have maintained to media that they'll be sticking around, you know, indefinitely after finals if need be, in order to get their demands met. And the university certainly has faced a lot of pressure, I think, most visibly externally, but certainly other folks on the inside of the university as well who would like to see this encampment go away. And so it is sort of a tense situation right now. There's not really a clear idea of what the future of the encampment is. And that's sort of been a lingering question on everyone's mind, especially after the police action in which 34 protesters were arrested. At the same time, as much as there might be, you know, calls from the inside for Madison to take down the encampment, there's also a sizable amount of faculty who support the encampment, support the student protesters. You know, some of the folks who were arrested, I believe four is the count at this point, were faculty members who were there to support students in the protests. And so I think there's also a sizable amount of faculty who are in support of this encampment. And that's a pretty tense situation for UW to be in, given that, you know, those are the folks who are teaching students. And just on Monday, we saw over 200 faculty members walk out and attend a faculty senate meeting in order to, you know, voice their displeasure with the police action and with the university response to protesters.
A lot going on, to say the least. And I just wanted to get a final pulse check. What's coming up for you as you report on the protests at the university you attend and you're set to graduate from next semester and the protests you're seeing across the state?
It's been an interesting time. I think Wednesday, I'm willing to say this, was probably one of the most stressful reporting experiences I've ever had. And it's tough to watch what was happening to people who might be your professors or students, coworkers that you know. And so that's, you know, definitely something that was on my mind as I was reporting it. It's been a tense time on campus in general. And so I really don't think that's off anyone's mind throughout the press corps reporting on this in terms of the amount of stress that people are under. And we're seeing this happen nationally. We're seeing it happen across the state. Even Milwaukee most prominently, but then Oshkosh and Eau Claire have now done protests as well. And so it's an interesting time to be a reporter in Madison reporting on this, especially because we are seeing the university become really concretely tied to these national stories about what's going on with the encampments. It definitely feels like a really intense moment for students, both in the encampment and outside the encampment.
Well, Liam, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for taking some time and talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Jamie.
Liam Barron writes for Isthmus and The Nation. He spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez on May 8th, a few days before the agreement between student protesters and UW leadership was reached. You can find more coverage of the protests on our website, wuwm.com. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this year's election. The third episode is now available, and new episodes drop every Wednesday. Find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. In about 20 minutes, we'll speak with a world champion taxidermist who had a long career at the Milwaukee Public Museum. But first, we'll learn about the millions of cicadas that are about to emerge from underground in Wisconsin after 17 years. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The cicadas are coming. Millions of them. The country is buzzing this year for an epic insect event. The emergence of two different broods of periodical cicadas. One group appears every 13 years. Another group, called Brood 13, appears every 17 years. The last time the two broods overlapped was 1803, before Wisconsin was even a state. Southern Wisconsin is home to Brood 13. To learn more about the cicadas and how to experience them, WUWM's Lena Tran speaks with PJ Leash, an entomologist with UW-Madison Extension.
What can we expect this summer?
Well, in just a few weeks or about a month or so, things are going to get pretty noisy in some parts of Wisconsin, and that's because of the emergence of our Brood 13 periodical cicadas, which have a 17-year life cycle. So they were last out in 2007 and prior to that back in 1990. And you can keep counting backwards all the way into the 1800s. But these insects are really fascinating because they emerge at these long extended time intervals of 17 years. It's a little mind-boggling to think of an insect living that long period. But they come out at these long time intervals and also in massive numbers. And that might be part of a survival strategy, because if you come out in such massive numbers, and these insects are fairly clumsy, so vertebrates like birds and mammals and fish are going to gorge themselves on these things. Plenty of the cicadas will be eaten, but there's going to be lots more that can still survive and reproduce. So that makes these insects pretty unique. So some parts of the state will have these coming out in huge numbers, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in relatively small areas.
That is so cool. What kinds of conditions are the cicadas waiting for?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. These insects have been feeding below ground for essentially 17 years at this point. They feed on the roots of trees. And in that 17th year, they are waiting for the soil conditions to be just right. And we know from some scientific studies, a key factor for emergence is the temperature of the soil at a depth of 8 inches. It has to get above 64 degrees Fahrenheit. I've been checking weather stations around the state, and at the moment, soil temperatures in southern Wisconsin are in about the mid to higher 50s. So we're getting close, a couple more weeks, and we're going to be in that temperature range that they need. So we have to hit that soil temperature of 64 degrees at a depth of 8 inches, and that won't necessarily trigger it immediately. It kind of primes the system, so to speak. But around that same time, if we get a decent rainfall and that rain percolates down into these channels, that also seems to spur on the activities. So again, it's just going to be a few weeks away for some parts of Wisconsin.
And the cool thing about this, I think, is that it almost lets you time travel to where you were the last time this happened. Where were you 17 years ago? You know, do you have cicada memories?
So unfortunately, I do not. I actually turned 40 years old next year, and I have never seen these before with my own eyes.
So, oh man, and you're a Wisconsin native?
Yes, I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin in Racine County. Back in 2007, when they were last out in the state, I missed them because I moved from Racine County to come to Madison to start graduate school at the time. So I'm kicking myself. I missed them that year. I missed them in 1990. I'm going to make sure I see them this year and make sure my kids get to see them too. Because when I think about it, it's a little bit like that solar eclipse we just had. Folks drove sometimes across the country to experience something like that. Well, these cicadas in Wisconsin, because they only come out every 17 years, you might only have a handful of opportunities in your entire life to witness these insects coming out in these tremendous numbers in the Badger State. And that's really unique and really cool and really special.
It is really special. So they spend most of their lives underground. You know, what does the best summer ever look like to a periodic cicada? And how does emergence fit into their life cycle?
Only adult insects can reproduce. So they are juveniles below ground. They are going to come out of the ground, crawl out, and then the juveniles are going to climb onto vertical surfaces. That could be the trunk of a tree or a fence post or something else nearby. they are going to molt and leave that old exoskeleton behind. And you'll see those around. Those will be evidence of molting. But once they molt and they transform to the adult stage, it takes a little while for them to darken and harden. And those adults will only be out for about a month. So really, statistically speaking, 98% or so of their entire life is spent below ground in the dark, feeding on tree roots. They come out for about a month as adults. The main goal that they have is to find a mate. And the way to go about doing that is to make a lot of noise. Specifically, the males have these membranes on the side of their body called timbals. And it's like the membrane on a drum. You can use muscles to cause vibrations, and that produces the sound. So for this month or so while they were out, it's the males essentially singing or screaming to attract the attention of females for mating purposes. The females can't sing back, but at a close range, the females can snap her wings. And it's going to sound just like someone snapping their fingers. And so you get this little back and forth calling between males and females. Eventually they mate. The females will then lay eggs. And a few weeks later, they're done and gone for 17 more years.
And the young cicadas will head back underground for the next 17 years.
Not immediately, though. It turns out what the females do is they will go to small twigs. They're really fond of twigs on trees that are about the diameter of a pencil, give or take. And so the female has this egg-laying structure that under the microscope, it looks like a spear or a pocket knife. She'll literally cut slits into these twigs and then insert batches of eggs. And those eggs will sit there for many weeks, maybe somewhere in the ballpark of 6 or so weeks. Then this very small juveniles come out of those eggs and they drop down to the ground. They rain down to the soil, but they're so small, it's probably going unnoticed. At that point, they burrow below ground where they're going to hang out there for 17 more years.
What is this life cycle an evolutionary response to? Like, why do we think that they do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And partly, we don't fully understand. We can speculate and make some educated guesses that might explain, but still there's some unknowns about their biology. One thought, though, is that if you are an insect that emerges in tremendous numbers on a very regular basis, say every year or every other year, in that case, animals that feed on you are going to catch on, because if raccoons and skunks and birds know they can rely on you on an annual basis, their populations are probably going to increase. That's probably going to decrease your populations because there's more of them to feed on you as cicadas. But if you come out at these very long time scales, most other forms of wildlife, vertebrates, birds, and mammals probably aren't living quite that long, so they can't catch on to this pattern. And so that's thought that evolutionarily, it might help with their survival. Again, it goes hand in hand. You emerge at these long time intervals, but you do so in such massive numbers that you overwhelm and essentially satiate anything that feeds on you. They're going to have full bellies, and there's still plenty of cicadas around to mate and successfully reproduce.
Right, right. So what kinds of threats do cicadas face? You know, I'm thinking about all the development that could happen in a 17-year period, or how climate change might throw them off.
My impression is that on shorter time scales, you know, in our lifetime, probably the biggest immediate threat to them would be land use changes, because the cicadas feed on tree roots, and those trees need to be there for very long periods of time. And so if those trees are cut down for an agricultural field or a parking lot or housing or whatever other purpose, and those trees are cut down and gone, the cicadas that were feeding on those roots will die out in those spots. So over time, the range of these insects, it's probably shrinking due to land use changes. Here in Wisconsin, for example, we historically have had records in counties like Waukesha, Milwaukee County, but I have not seen any confirmed reports from counties like that in really decades. Some other areas, just as an example, historically, we had some documented here in the Madison area, but the last record of those I could find was 1956. They haven't been spotted in 60 to 70 years at this point. So those land use changes can be a really important threat to cicadas, kind of in a shorter immediate time scale. But when you think about climate change, we don't fully know what that is going to mean for cicadas. One thing that is almost certainly going to happen is if we have changing climate, we have earlier springs as an example, that's probably going to shift their emergence time. So they'll pop out and emerge earlier in the year. What will the impact of that be? It's really hard to tell at this point. One other potential complication, though, is if with climate change, we get more extreme weather swings. And if you had years where you maybe had an early warm up in, say, February, and then it got brutally cold again in March, just these weird weather swings, that might have some potential impacts on these insects in the long run. There's been some hints at that in the literature where you have an early warm up followed by a frost. And if that has an impact on the host trees and some changes in the phytochemicals within the plant, that might have some subtle impacts on the cicadas too. But for the most part, we don't fully understand what these changes will mean for these insects in the long run.
So you've been poring through all of those historical records, trying to understand where they'll occur. Where can folks in southern, southeastern Wisconsin go to experience this themselves?
Yeah, so there's a number of spots tucked around. And what I did this last winter, I dug through about 150 years of old newspaper articles, government reports, and other documents to try and find our best idea of where these occur. Because one really important thing to understand about these insects, and this is often overlooked, is they can be really geographically isolated. And I've been telling folks their distribution, it's like pins on a map. So some of the maps going around will shade in entire counties, giving the impression that they're widely distributed everywhere, which isn't the case. They're restricted to individual isolated geographic spots on the map. So in southern Wisconsin, perhaps the single best spot to see them would be the Lake Geneva area. I have seen records from that part of the state going back well into the 1800s. We also know there's some decent populations near Beloit, near Janesville. There's one particular park just northwest of Janesville. It used to be a Boy Scout camp. Now it is Rock River Heritage County Park. And there was a strong emergence noted there in 2007. We've got some activity noted in Spring Green and a lot of tucked away spots in Iowa County as well. But if you want to know more about the distribution, earlier this year, I released a periodical cicada website for the state of Wisconsin. It's cicadas.wisc.edu. And on that site, I actually have a page dedicated to when and where they occur. And it includes a map with this research I've done, and also a column going county by county, talking about some of the important locations.
Are there things that we don't know about cicadas that entomologists like yourself hope to use this summer to explore or get more information on?
Yeah, that's a great question. From my standpoint, my main interest at the moment is to get a better feel for where these insects really occur in Wisconsin. And again, we talked about some of the threats that might be impacting where they occur in the state. Maybe they were in spots historically and no longer occur there. We know that's the case here in Madison. And so on that cicada website that created, I actually developed a community science project. So folks can go on there and submit sightings from within Wisconsin. And I'd really love to hear about any sightings to help fine-tune our map and better understand where these occur. But there are some other really cool research questions that have been asked by scientists out there. One thing that I've heard discussed recently that we just don't fully understand, as an example, is how the cicadas know to all emerge at the same time. We talked about soil temperatures and rainfall can influence them, but how do they really know to emerge at the same time? What if some emerged early? Mm-hmm. Those would probably get picked off by birds or other wildlife. That is a mystery we don't fully understand at this point. I'd love to see someone try and figure that out.
That is really exciting.
One thing I would mention, and this is a common question that I've gotten from the public, is are these cicadas harmful or dangerous in any way? Wildlife is going to gorge themselves on these things. They are pretty palatable. Humans can even eat them. If you go online, there's a lot of recipes. So they're really quite harmless to people. They really don't bite. They can't sting you at all or anything like that. They technically can cause a little bit of damage to plants, and that is when the females go to lay eggs. Again, she uses that spear-like egg-laying structure called an ovipositor. She cuts these slits in small twigs, and that can cause those twigs to die and break off. So those leaves will turn brownish. If this occurs and those twigs snap, we call it flagging. And if this occurs on a large tree, it's going to be very noticeable, but it really doesn't have an impact on the tree's health in the long run. So you don't need to worry about it. Perhaps the only situation I would be concerned about plants is if I lived in a known cicada hotspot and I had recently planted trees. If the cicadas end up harming the outer maybe 6 to 12 inches of those twigs on a big tree, that's a drop in the bucket. But on a very small young tree, that might end up being a pretty high percentage of the overall tree's canopy. So if you have a recently planted tree, I suggest covering it with fine mesh netting and tie it along the trunk of the tree. That will physically keep the insects off. If the cicadas can't get to the tree, they can't harm it. And one other thing is if you live in a known cicada hotspot and you're planning on planting a tree this year, I would probably wait until July when the cicadas are going to be done for the year and we won't see them again for 17 more years.
Okay, good to know. What are you personally looking forward to?
The thing I'm most excited about it is simply to experience this phenomenon. As I mentioned, it's something that in Wisconsin, you can live here your entire life, and you might only have a handful of opportunities to see this insect in the state. And I turn 40 next year. I could have seen them twice already, but I've missed it both times. So I'm really excited to see them, to experience the sheer numbers of them and experience their singing, because it's this otherworldly science fiction-esque sound that they can produce. So I'm really excited to see and hear them with my own eyes and ears. Tears and
perspiration. That was UW-Madison Extension entomologist P.J. Leash, speaking with WUWM's Lena Tran. You can find more information on the resources he talked about at WUWM.com. Step to the stage to pick up my degree. And the locusts sang off in the distance, yeah. The locusts sang such a sweet melody. Oh, the locusts sang off in the distance. Now the locusts sang, and they were singing for me. The Republican National Convention is coming to Milwaukee in July. You can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories you hear on Lake Effect and WUWM. Many Milwaukeeans are familiar with Samson, the beloved gorilla who you can see at the Milwaukee Public Museum. We'll speak with the person who brought Samson back to life next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Yeah, give me a chill. Oh, the locusts sang such a sweet melody. Oh, the locusts sang. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Many Milwaukeeans are familiar with Samson, the beloved gorilla who lived at the Milwaukee County Zoo until he died in 1981. Now Samson lives at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Wildlife artist and world champion taxidermist Wendy Christensen made the popular recreation of Samson that's on display there. In the nearly 36 years she worked at the museum, Christensen also created hundreds of animal mounts and sculptures for various exhibits. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez speaks with Christensen about her passion for wildlife art and how she recreated Samson.
I want to take it back to the beginning. When and how did you become interested in taxidermy?
Oh boy. I guess I've always was destined to become a taxidermist. And I know that sounds silly, but seriously, I had an interest in preserving animals from a very, very young age. I'm extremely passionate about wildlife. A lot of it started out when I was young and I would see animals hit by cars laying on the roadside. You know, I always thought, oh gosh, what a shame. It would be so cool if I could make that animal look lifelike again.
I guess when, around when? You said you were a child, boy. So when and how old were you?
Okay, when I was 2 or 3, my mom told me I picked up a minnow out of the bait bucket, and I walked around all day petting the minnow.
Oh.
Obviously, the minnow had seen better days, but I was just that much intrigued with animals and just wanting to have them a part of my life. When I was 7, my dad, he hit a coyote, and I just thought that was such a beautiful animal. There was some way that I could preserve that. I felt helpless because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to do anything at 7. And when I was 12, I took Northwestern School of Taxidermy, which is kind of funny because all the old-timer taxidermists is how they started. It's a correspondence course by mail. It got me started, and I sat in my basement, and I started with my pigeon. They recommend you start with a pigeon. And when I was 14, I took a mini course from a local taxidermist so I could actually see things hands-on. And he was not a great taxidermist, but it did help me. You know, it helped me pique my interest. And when I was 15, I started working for a taxidermist that ended up being the person that probably helped me more than any. Because in that time period, late 70s, early 80s, you did not have access to all the knowledge that we have today. Taxidermy was a big secret. People didn't share their processes. Like today, it's all over. You can learn from internet, you can YouTube, you can get books, you can get video. Back then, there was only a couple of books.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is you kind of worked your way up to work at the Milwaukee Public Museum. How do you even approach working with such unique animals?
A lot of research. So if you wanted to mount a deer, say an example, there are all kinds of commercially available mannequins. The mannequin is what the skin gets glued and sewed and mounted over. And the mannequins are catalogs of books that you can pick different sizes, different poses. And as an artist myself, I make some of those. They're all hand sculpted,
Wow. Those
mannequins. But when you're doing something like an ocelot or a jaguar, those are not commercially available mannequins, or monkeys, primates. So you have to learn how to make them 100% yourself.
So you have to learn the measurements of that animal.
Yes, you have to learn the anatomy and the structure and what makes that animal, the essence of that animal, as I like to say. And that's where the study part is involved. Even though, you know, musculature is similar on every animal, it's still slightly different.
Right. You really have an eye for detail. And you were talking about how you've sculpted horses, gorillas. How long does it take to work on a project like that, a large project like that?
A large project. Okay. In the case of the gorilla, I'm assuming you're referring to Samson. In order to do him, that required a lot of research on what made him unique to himself, too. Not just a gorilla, but I had to capture Samson's personality and Samson's expression. So I did a lot of research on that. And so the research part takes, and the same with like the horses you referred to, those are King Tut's horses. They're ancient Arabians. I spent probably a couple of months doing research on what made ancient Arabians of that time different than our modern Arabians. Mm. To answer a very long story here, trying to make it a little shorter here, Samson took a year approximately, but it was because I was actually on display in the public making Samson. They wanted me to make him in front of the public. The museum did. So even though that is something I probably could have done in a little much quicker time fashion, the whole exhibit was up for a year. So they wanted me to work on him while I was down there. So I worked a couple hours a day, putting a few hairs in here and talking to people and putting a few hairs in there. So that was probably about a year. When it came to the horses, now the first one took me a lot longer because of all the research. And so I think he took 8 months. And then the second one was like 5 months, something like that. It went a lot faster. But it's all painstakingly, you know, hand sculpted everything. And yeah, some of those projects are long term. And then like when I did all the mammals for the rainforest, I think I did 43 animals in a year and a half. So it just depended on the time frame too, and if we had a time restraint, and then how many specimens I had to do.
So I guess, can you walk me through the process of research is already a big part. Sculpting it is a huge part.
Yes.
But then you said hairs one by one.
Oh, okay. Well, in the case of Samson, he is 100% artificial. The Samson on display at the museum is called a recreation. And the reason he is a recreation is his skin was not mountable. So he died in 1981. There was a taxidermist that was hired to mount him for the zoo. So that gentleman came out and he skinned Samson and he made a death mask of Samson. And then Samson's skin sat in his freezer for 3 or 4 years. And then eventually the zoo relinquished him to the museum. So I went to flesh it and prepare it for tanning and all the process that's required. And his skin was what we call slipping, which means the outer layer of epidermis was peeling off in large pieces with the hair. So that made him unmountable. So I saved his skin because it was very valuable scientifically, because he was a wild captured gorilla. So his DNA and everything could be, you know, used for research. And then when it came to making the recreation, we had a president at the time of the museum that I had proposed the idea of making this recreation. He said, "I like it and I want you to do it in front of the public." So we started out the first messy stages of the process were up in my studio with a webcam on me. So you could log in from home and watch me actually making him in my studio. Then we took him downstairs and put him on display, or me making him on display, and built a whole exhibit about gorillas all around it. It was very, very popular and really a cool exhibit. So we had his skeleton, okay. And Samson was one of the largest gorillas ever in captivity. So there is a company by the name of Bone Clones that makes artificial casts of things. So they had an extra large male gorilla that I purchased, the skeleton. It's made of plastic. And then looking at his real bones, I lengthened each one of the bones to make it Samson-sized. So from that bone structure, I then bulked up all the muscles and all the body anatomy using two-part foam that you mix together, it expands and it hardens quite hard. And then I carve it. Now, that's his body. When it came to his face, I took that death mask that the other taxidermist had made and I completely retooled it. Because when you have a death mask, a cast of a dead animal, that's exactly what it is, a dead animal. So you don't have any muscle tone, you don't have blood pressure, you don't have expression. So I had to put all of that life back into it. It was very critical that I make those eyes. If those people that knew Samson, he always looked at you out of the corner of his eyes in disgust. It's just kind of funny. He had an attitude, and people loved his attitude. So I had to capture that. So then I worked on getting the eye set right. So when it came to making his hair in that, I implanted the hairs one hair at a time from the back of his nape of his neck all the way down to his chest. Because Samson's skin was saved, I sent 6 different parts of his hair, of his body, to a company that makes the hair for Hollywood, for the movie industry.
Whoa.
Yeah, and they matched it. They made it. They did the best job they could using, this took us back and forth like 5 months to get the right blends. And so the hair is made out of acrylic, yak hair, and goat hair. And then the hands and feet and the chest, I took casts of actual like gorilla skin and I made stamps kind of. And I stamped all the skin texture into the hands and the chest and everything. So it's a long story, but basically that's how I made him.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
How do you decide how you'll pose an animal or the story you want to convey?
If it were for a client, what the client would like, that's first and foremost. And I oftentimes, you know, make suggestions. But sometimes people will say, just take it and do whatever you want with it. You know, I trust you. Sometimes it's something that you want to show us something specific off. And here's an example. This isn't my freelance work, but in the museum in the rainforest, we have a jaguar that I've mounted. And the jaguar is kind of on a crouching pose. And the reason it's in a crouching pose relates to a story you just did about the zoo animals and what they do with them. And that particular jaguar was one that died at the zoo, and it had had a necropsy done on it. So its entire belly was shaved. So in order to mount it, I needed to put it in a pose that hid that belly.
Wow.
So, I mean, things like that will dictate the pose.
And when I'm thinking of Samson, how you were saying, like, the expressive face, I'm sure you were looking at a lot of photos of him.
Yes, and thank you for mentioning that. So when I was doing Samson on display, I was so fortunate to have Sam LaMalfa with me. Sam LaMalfa was the zookeeper at the zoo in Samson's last 10 years of his life. And Sam retired from the zoo, and he became a docent at the museum. So Sam had all these fantastic photographs, and he was sitting on the table next to me. I'm making Samson, and Sam is telling stories because people wanted to know, you know, they wanted to swap their Samson stories. So Sam was right there and able to interact with the public, but he was very helpful to me. I could bounce questions off of him. Does this look right? Does this look? Did Samson do this? And so that was really helpful.
You had someone that worked directly with Samson. That's amazing. So you left the Milwaukee Public Museum in 2018 and started focusing on more freelance projects. So what work are you mostly doing now?
So I've done a little bit of museum work, some contract work, some habitats, and doing some diorama work. I've been sculpting a lot of antlers. I think that's something that I really enjoy. I can do it in my basement and take my time and make, you know, very realistic antlers. Say you have a very large set of deer antlers that you shot or somebody shot, and it is destroyed in a fire, or it's lost and somebody stole it. I can take your measurements and photographs if you have, and many hunters do have the measurements and the photographs of their trophy deer or whatever animal, and I can sculpt your deer. It's all hand sculpted, but I like to do that kind of stuff. I like to repair antlers, like if they are broken from fighting or whatever, I can rebuild a whole side and to match the other side. And I think I enjoy those little putsy things like that that are ultra high detail.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask, do you have any advice for people who might be interested in becoming a taxidermist or getting into this
You
art?
Would be surprised how many ladies, I don't know how to explain it, but it's very popular, especially with ladies now, to do novelty taxidermy, things like that. Soft mount taxidermy is something that's really coming of age now, which soft mount taxidermy are posable animals. And there's some of them are really, really amazingly realistic. They're really well done. Don't try to get into the museum world. I am 100% serious, because there really is, unless you're going to do contract work through a big company or something like that, there are really not any more full-time museum taxidermists. There's only one that I know of left. And he was my counterpart in the LA County Museum. And I think he's still there. And it's sad, it's in the United States, it's that way. In Europe, every university has a taxidermist, every one. And they're much ahead of us as far as their desire to have taxidermists on staff.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about why?
I don't know 100% either. It's just in the day and age where budget cuts happen and they hire it out, they contract it out, I suppose. I'm guessing that's probably why.
Mm. Well, I think taxidermy is a true art, and
I do too. I love it.
Well, Wendy, thank you so much for speaking with me today and telling me more about your amazing and extensive career in being a taxidermist.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Wendy Christensen is a wildlife artist and world champion taxidermist. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. Samson the gorilla is just one of the many popular things to see at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Another popular exhibit is The Streets of Old Milwaukee. Richard Hederman works on the education staff at the museum, and he pays homage to the exhibit in this poem.
This is a poem I wrote that was inspired by the Streets of Old Milwaukee Gallery. And something to keep in mind as I read the poem is that its historical setting is largely from 1890 to 1917, when the U.S. entered World War I. And I particularly set the poem right around that time, as the country was becoming very concerned that we were going to enter a world war. So there are references in the poem to war looming on the horizon, the concern over that. So this is called Streets of Old Milwaukee. It is endless, the early October dusk, smelling of smoke and lit in the flare of gaslight. The butterfly in the mason jar folds its wings as if under the weight of dust. And the draft horses haul their shadows back to the stables. In the alley, the black cat tilts his head in the dark, listening for a rat in the grate, a spider on the wall, or something else we may never hear. Even the films in the Nickelodeon unspool silently in black, silver, and silken gray, the actors gesturing as though signaling for help. The kite, torn by rain, hangs snagged in the wires. The streetcar reaches its vanishing point as the barber summons his final customer, beckoning with his gleaming razor. In the saloon, the cards face down upon the table enfold their cache of prophecies. The Western Union messenger leans his bicycle against the fence. The gate is locked. The dead leaves scattered. Winter is coming, and so too a war that will strew telegrams from here to the Somme. Then the apothecary hoards his bottles, stoppered with the vapor of poppies. The player piano will jangle over the waves. The red service banners unfurled in the square will summon the clerk, the newsboy, the schoolmaster, to Ypres, the Marne, and Amiens. So where then is the funeral parlor, the windows shut, the thick drapes pulled tight against the gathering dark? And where, too, the undertaker with his heavy gloves to lay us all to rest?
Richard Hederman works on the education staff at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a shortage in primary care doctors. Plus, Bubbler Talk explores the engravings in the sidewalk on Brady Street. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.